From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Where does fear come from? Why are we sometimes paralyzed by fear and other times sent into bold action? And how can we learn to manage our fear, whether it has to do with a fear of public speaking or a life or death situation? This hour, we hear from Daniel Trinnell about a new University of Iowa study that has pinpointed the part of the brain that causes fear and how this discovery may affect the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. Then author Jeff Wise will tell us about extreme fear. That's the title of his book. In it, he surveys the science of your brain in danger. Share your most frightening experience this hour. We start right after the news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Where does fear come from? Why are we sometimes paralyzed by fear and other times spurred into bold action? And how can we learn to manage our fear, whether it has to do with a fear of public speaking or a life or death situation? This hour, we explore the science of fear. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by science writer Jeff Wise. Extreme Fear is the title of his latest book. But first, researchers at the University of Iowa have pinpointed the part of the brain that causes people to experience fear. It's a discovery that could improve treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and other anxiety conditions. Published in the January edition of the journal Current Biology, the study investigates how the emotion of fear depends on an almond-shaped brain region called the amygdala. Joining us to discuss the study and its implications, a senior author of the study, Daniel Trinnell, a University of Iowa professor of neurology and psychology. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you, Ben. Good afternoon and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you and good afternoon. Now, I understand the patient in this case study has a rare condition that destroyed her amygdala. Tell us about her.
Yes, she has a condition. It is very rare. There are, it's hard to know for sure, but maybe hundreds or 100 cases worldwide. So it's a very rare condition. The condition is a genetic condition that in about half the patients creates this mineralization, a calcium deposit in the amygdala structure on both sides of the brain, and effectively destroys the neural tissue in that structure so that the structure is rendered without function.
And this we could see in her behavior. How?
Well, so that's a good question, Ben. So actually, we saw this in her brain to begin with. She came to the attention of my colleague Antonio Damasio here in the neurology department at the University of Iowa Hospitals for some neurological symptoms. This was back in the the mid to late 80s, and we did a CT scan, which was absolutely striking in showing these lesions in the amygdala, these bilateral white spots that showed up on the CT scan. So that was kind of the first, wow, look at that, the amygdala is missing in this patient. And that prompted us to look at her with this question of what about her fear processing? That question was prompted by the fact that there was, at that time, quite a bit of work in animals that had implicated the amygdala as an important structure for processing fear. And now we had, an opportunity to pursue that question in a human patient.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you go about testing her fear processing?
The program of work, which was led by a colleague of mine, Ralph Adolphs, which encompassed work done kind of in the 1990 epoch, focused at first on her processing of fear in the facial expressions of other people, in scenes and in movies and that kind of thing. And we discovered that she had very significant deficits in that type of processing.
Mm-hmm. She just didn't react to those facial expressions as one would normally.
Right. She didn't see them as showing fear. She could see happy and surprise and things like that normally. family, but not fear. Now, a question that always persisted during that work was, what about her experience of fear? Does she experience fear? And when we presented our work, we would often get asked that question, and we weren't ever, you know, that confident in our answer to it because we didn't, we hadn't really put her to the test, and we, you know, we hadn't done, you know, you're confined by what you can do in a laboratory in terms of inducing fear in someone. So this new study that Justin Feinstein is the first author of, a graduate student of mine here at the University of Iowa, really put it to the test by doing these field experiments with this patient.
Mm-hmm. And so when she recalled, what you had her recall experiences that she had that should have been frightening, and in recalling them, you could tell that she was interpreting them differently than most people?
That's true, although she does have a couple of memories where I think there were very clear fear experiences. So she did experience fear as a child. There are a couple of incidents where she clearly, you know, remembers being afraid in a normal way. Mm-hmm. The field experiments that we reported in this new paper entailed, a couple of things. One was taking a trip to a pet shop and exposing the patient to live spiders and snakes. These are two, you know, of the most feared members of the animal kingdom, and incidentally, creatures that that the patient claims to despise and not like. Now, in that situation in the pet store, her behavior was remarkable for being fearless. She had just completely uninhibited approach behavior, curiosity, interacting with snakes and spiders, to the point where she had to be restrained by the pet store owner because she was attempting to interact with ones that that were not so safe.
Mm-hmm. Fear, and it created in the amygdala, as we understand it, alerts us to danger. So when you say that about this woman, wouldn't that put her at a higher risk of overlooking hazards, of not acting quickly enough to remove herself from potential danger?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So did you ask yourself the question, how is she even alive or surviving?
Absolutely. And I think the answer is by great good fortune, because she has been in quite a few very perilous situations that, it's exactly what you said, Ben. She did not pay attention to process normally clear signals of danger and put herself in situations that got her into a lot of trouble. And it is, I think, by considerable good luck that she is alive and well and able to participate in our experiments at this point.
When we say someone is fearless, and we usually mean that as a compliment, we don't actually really mean fearless, do we? Because being absolutely fearless, as this case study would point out, is a dangerous thing. We wouldn't want any soldiers who are completely without fear, would we?
Well, you don't, you know, having no fear is not going to be adaptive. I mean, it wouldn't survive as a trait in the gene pool because, I mean, as you've kind of alluded to, Ben, you wouldn't, you know, get away from danger, and you would, you know, you would do away with people who had no fear over the course of a couple of iterations of the, you know, genetic transmission. So, no, that's not an adaptive trait. Now, you know, like most biological traits, fear is probably, you know, relatively normally distributed in the population and ranges from, you know, people who are pretty fearless and who, you know, to the point of putting themselves in harm's way, and then kind of into the normal range, and then you would get into the other end of the distribution where people are too fearful and have, you know, psychiatric disorders that involve too much fear.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about that in a moment. I want to reach out to our listeners to ask our listeners for any personal stories of being gripped by fear. Say it was perhaps when you were even speaking in public, asked to give that speech or skydiving or even saying your wedding vows. How did your body, did your mind react? What did you observe about that feeling of intense fear? 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, 1-866-780-9100. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Daniel Turnell is with us, a University of Iowa professor of neurology and psychology, lead author of a new study that pinpoints the part of the brain that causes people to experience fear, a case study of a woman who had her amygdala, seems to be the origin of fear in our brains, destroyed, and they've studied her. How could this discovery, Professor Turnell, lead to new interventions for those in our society who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, other anxiety disorders, as you mentioned?
Great question, Ben. Let me just clarify part of your question, though. We would like to keep clear a distinction between fear and anxiety. They're somewhat different. You know, they're kind of related in ways, but they have a fundamental difference, which is that fear is more of a sort of in-the-moment emotion, sort of necessary for survival. Anxiety is much more of a, you know, worrying about the future, a more future-oriented type of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And our work, I think, speaks most directly to fear-related disorders. And PTSD, which you mentioned, is kind of the classic example of one such, you know, and very common disorder, especially with, you know, with the war going on and people coming back from situations that have created PTSD. Phobias, which are also common, are another good example of fear kind of run amok and, you know, over the normal amount. Our work, you know, it suggests that targeting the amygdala by therapy would be effective in treating such disorders. And, you know, medications are, you know, a good starting point, and we can, you know, hope to create medications that are effective in targeting the neural transmission that occurs in the amygdala and basically ratcheting down its activity in patients with, you know, too much fear that causes a psychiatric disorder.
And so these would be different, acting differently in our brains than, say, a sedative.
Yes, yes. The idea would be, you know, if we know the neural structure and we can, you know, use work, especially in animals, to, you know what types of neurotransmitters are preferred by nuclei in that structure, you know, we can really make the medication specific. Mm-hmm. And therapy is also important. Psychotherapy is another way that we can target the amygdala and, you know, again, try to ratchet down its activity.
And how does this discovery, your work, relate to possibly lowering the high rate of suicide among returning troops?
Great question. We would hope that by treating, for example, patients, troops, combat veterans or people with PTSD, treating PTSD effectively, we can, you know, get them sort of reemerged in society and readjusted and back on the track of being mentally and psychologically well-adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
PTSD has been notoriously difficult to treat. It's got a high rate of people relapse, and it's hard to really get people over it. So we're very excited about our finding in terms of, you know, now we know more about the neural structure that we can target with therapy.
What is our understanding of what exactly is happening inside the brain, inside the amygdala of someone suffering from PTSD?
Well, the quick explanation would be that the person has learned an association between stimuli and a fear response and doesn't extinguish that. And in fact, the association can get stronger with time, so that stimuli that remind the person of, you know, fear-inducing conditions. And those can even be internal, memories, dreams, and things like that. Reinstate the feeling of fear and prompt the person into panic responses and, you know, physiological arousal that's maladaptive.
Mm-hmm. So the idea here from perhaps a drug, something that would act on the amygdala, would not be to erase these memories, but to, what, disconnect them as stimuli?
Yeah, kind of extinguish the connection between stimuli and the fear response. response, right?
Is that the same thing that, say, a cognitive therapy approach would be doing?
Exactly. Yep. That's why I wanted to mention that, Ben, and that's a very good question because, yes, that's exactly what you'd be after with a therapy approach.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many Americans suffer from fear disorders? So much so that it, I guess, when does it become a disorder? Anxiety and fear in anyone's life.
Yeah, the how many question I don't know the answer to, Ben. That's a, you know, I think there are, you know, many, probably tens of thousands, and maybe more than that, who suffer from, you know, clinical disorders. What makes it a disorder is when the fear, you know, really interferes with social, interpersonal, and occupational functioning. When those aspects of our lives are rendered, you know, are really, you know, you just can't function normally in terms of your relationships with people and your job performance, then you've got a disorder.
Mm-hmm. And what are some warning signs that that may point to a person needing treatment for an anxiety disorder? What might you see as symptoms, red flags?
Well, again, we want to focus on phobias rather than anxiety disorders. I would, you know, nightmares, avoidance behavior, hypervigilance, people with, you know, with sort of obsessive thoughts about things that they can't get rid of, people who, you know, go to great lengths to avoid certain situations that, you know, that were, that got them fearful in the first place. Those are some warning signs.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference between an anxiety disorder and a panic attack?
Well, and the anxiety disorders, as I said, have more to do with worry about, you know, kind of what's going to happen next down the road. They're more to do with the future, as opposed to phobias and post-traumatic stress disorder, which are more in the moment types of problems.
Mm-hmm. When someone has a panic attack, it feels like it's in the moment. It feels like a person is having a heart attack, possibly, right?
Correct. Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. But it's often in panic attack, a person doesn't think it's a mental disorder because they aren't aware consciously of being afraid of something, are they? In some cases.
In some cases, yes. And
it just feels like a gripping pain in their chest.
Right, right. And of course, it's very physiological, so it's very real. It's a, you know, your body lets you know that you've got something going on.
Mm-hmm. Would this explain something I had as a teen going up in an airplane for the first time? It was in a small Piper Cub airplane. I was taken up a few thousand feet. I was not aware of being afraid for my safety. I felt I could look around and intellectually understand that I was safe, yet my arms locked up completely. I was immobile. What was happening in my brain?
Your amygdala was processing the sensory information and doing its job, which is to send signals to the brainstem and the hypothalamus that this is a, you know, potentially dangerous situation and we need a fear response going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And your sensation of your arms stiffening and sort of freezing is exactly the manifestation of that.
And so why wasn't my higher brain processing this and able to override the amygdala and tell it everything's fine?
Well, often we can do that. I'm not sure what happened to you in that situation.
It was a perfectly fine plane ride. There was a little bit of turbulence, but there were no worries, really.
So you probably did do that. Sounds like you did do that.
Only when I got back on the ground, actually.
but it's a great illustration, Ben, because our higher brain, or what amounts to our prefrontal cortex, does have the ability to override that response. And as you say, you know, intellectualize and say, okay, you know, things are under control. The pilot knows what he's doing. You know, we're going to land. I'm going to be okay.
Right. How far have we come in our understanding of fear in recent decades? If we look back several decades, what advances have we made?
Well, that's a great question, and this discovery of the amygdala has been one of the real breakthroughs in neuroscience in the last, you know, I don't know, 15 years. I've been in the field for close to three decades, and you don't see too many things where you're like, wow, that's a real breakthrough, and you know, it really stands up with the test of time and with replication. This connection between fear and the amygdala is very, very strong, very robust. You see this well replicated across different, you know, species, types of situations. So it really is a breakthrough in terms of our understanding of the neural machinery that, you know, process fear.
Mm-hmm. So again, this case study that was brought out described in the report in the journal Current Biology tells us what, in addition, we have, if I'm not mistaken, known for many years that the amygdala is a central part of generating fear. What does this case study tell us about the nature of fear that we didn't quite know before?
Great question again, Ben. It tells us that the amygdala is critical to induce fear from, you know, from sensory information coming from the outside world, visual, auditory information coming into our brain, that information, that you need the amygdala to induce the action pattern of fear, you know, that gets played out in your body. Now we, you know, prior to this, we knew, number one, we knew, you know, from this patient and some like her that the amygdala is important to recognize fear, but we didn't know about the experience part of it. And number two, we knew from animal work that there's a connection between, you know, sensory processing and fear behavior via the amygdala. But the big limitation with the animals is they can't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And a human can. So,
but we are also limited with humans because we can't just go scare them any which way we would like.
Exactly. Yep. Yep.
What are the rules there?
Well, the rules are very strict. You treat people ethically, and people participate in research with informed consent, so that they know what they're getting themselves into, and agree to do it. You know, we have a very high bar, and as psychologists, we set an even higher bar with our human patients and subjects.
If I sign a paper that says, "Go ahead, scare me anyway, safely that you can think of," is that okay?
It's okay if it's been approved by the Institutional Review Board, which is very mindful of, you know, are we going to leave you in a state of, you know, phobia for the rest of your adult life, which would not be okay.
Okay.
Even if you agreed to do it.
Okay.
Even if you agreed to do it for $100.
Professor Trunell, thank you very much. It's been an interesting conversation. University of Iowa Professor of Neurology and Psychology, Daniel Trunell, thank you.
Thank you, Ben. It was a real pleasure. Thanks for talking.
Okay. He's a lead author in a new study issued in a report of the journal Current Biology. And when we come back, we'll be joined by author Jeff Wise to talk about his book, Extreme Fear, The Science of Your Brain in Danger. We'd like to hear some of your stories of fear. 1-866-780-9100. What did your body, your mind do? What did you observe in that situation of fear that we all have in our past? Was it something that paralyzed you or gave you great strength and mental clarity? 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Stage fright kept this artist from performing in public for years. Can you name her?
Into the party like you were walking onto a yacht. Your hat strategically dipped below one eye. The scarf that was out. You had one eye in the mirror. You watched yourself go by.
And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us over the noon hour today. We're exploring fear this hour. Fear is a mysterious force. It can sabotage our ability to think clearly, can drive us to blind panic, but it can also give us a superhuman speed, a strength, and powers of perception. Fear has baffled humankind for ages, but it's now yielding its secrets to science, as we heard in our first half hour in a discussion with Daniel Trunell of the University of Iowa. Well, we've all heard the term fight or flight, that people respond to danger either by fleeing in terror or staying put to fight through it. We'd like to hear your story of being gripped by fear and how you overcame it. 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Well, this simple model of fight or flight has been replaced by a more complex understanding of the fear response. Joining us now to talk about what we've learned about fear, veteran science journalist Jeff Wise. His book, Extreme Fear, The Science of Your Brain in Danger, delves into the latest research on the brain's hidden fear pathways. Jeff Wise also writes the I'll Try Anything column for Popular Mechanics. He joins us from his home in Manhattan. Jeff Wise, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben. It's my pleasure.
Now, as in your Popular Mechanics articles, you favor a hands-on approach in researching this book. You volunteered, for instance, to jump out of an airplane while wearing sensors. You endured a four-hour simulated missile attack on a Navy destroyer. Tell us about one of these experiences that really gave you a fright.
Right. Well, Ben, thanks. I got interested in the subject because I was doing these kinds of articles in my career as a journalist, and I found myself in situations much like the one that you experienced, where you're maybe up in a small plane or some kind of other unfamiliar situation, and you find your body reacting in a way that you can't really explain. Intellectually, you feel like, well, this plane is perfectly safe. I trust the pilot. I don't think the wings are going to fall off. And yet my arms are stiff, or my mouth is dry, or my heart is racing. And it's mysterious. And the more intense that fear becomes, the more mysterious this force seems to overcome our conscious thoughts. And so I wanted to learn more about it, and I contacted a researcher at Stony Brook University here in New York, and she enrolled me in her study. One of the things you were addressing earlier in the hour was, you know, how do you perform experiments on human beings when you're trying to induce them into a state of high fear? It's maybe not very ethical to take someone and tell them that you're going to give them a multiple choice quiz and then you throw them out of an airplane. Although, you know, human experimentation used to be a lot less regulated than it is today. And in my book, I tell a story about some Army recruits who were put into a transport plane.
Oh, this was the Task Fighter Project, 1962.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And they didn't tell them that they were in a psychological experiment, and they turned off one of the engines in flight and said, oh, by the way, we're going to crash. Please fill out these insurance forms so that your survivors will get the life insurance payment. And the test, this is almost kind of insanely cruel, but the life insurance form was actually a disguised psychological test of their mental skills, and they wanted to find out if being intensely afraid would affect your mental skills, as of course it does. And I don't think they got any useful data out of it, because I don't know if anybody was really able to fulfill this life insurance form, because, you know, they were pretty sure they were about to be killed. And so, so the way around that problem in an ethical way is you get people who are already going to jump out of an airplane for the first time. Mm-hmm. So what this researcher does is he would put up a flyer in the skydive center saying, if you're about to take a skydive anyway for the first time, why not let us attach sensors to your body and we'll measure your heart rate and your lung volume and so forth. And so I volunteered to do this because I was interested in it for my own purposes. And so I sure enough, I went out and I jumped out of an airplane one fine autumn morning. And as I was about to jump out, I thought, what have I gotten myself into doing this? This is just, I would have been happier anywhere else in the world than at the edge of that door about to jump out of that airplane. And sure enough, later she talked through the data with me, and my heart rate had gone through the roof, and all of my endocrine levels had gone through the roof, and I had just completely flipped out. But that's what happens, you know. So this is the sort of the thing that spurred me to get interested in this in the first place, is this having witnessed it firsthand how your brain gets taken over,
right,
almost like by an external force. You are not in charge of yourself anymore.
Yeah. Right, jumping out of an airplane with a parachute on the way it is these days is probably statistically safer than walking across a Manhattan street, isn't it?
Yeah, except for that one time. And and it's always that one time that's very much playing in your head when you go out. But, you know, it's an irrational fear, but the point I try to make is that all fear is irrational. if you find yourself in a scary situation and sure enough your heart is racing and everything, you think, oh, it's a rational fear, I understand why I'm feeling that fear. But we have these two different systems in our brain, as your previous guest was talking about. Your amygdala is looking at all the sensory information that's coming in, and it's making its own judgment. And you, the conscious self, is looking at, is getting access to the same sensory data, but it's reaching a different conclusion. So it's like two separate jury members on the same jury. So my point is, when I say that all fear is irrational, your amygdala is always making its own decision. It's not mm-hmm. checking in with your intellect. Now, as your previous guest said, it's possible sometimes, especially when the fear is fairly mild, for your conscious mind to reassess the situation and say, you know what? This isn't really that scary. I'm only sitting in a movie theater. I'm holding a box of popcorn. I don't need to be flipping out right now. And you can kind of calm yourself down sometimes. But because most of us rarely get into a true life or death situation, I think it's surprising for most of us when we do to find that we really are out of control. And I blog about that. I have a blog about this at jeffwise.wordpress.com, where people have been writing in and sharing their experiences, and it's remarkable how many people have had at least once in their life a time like yours where they're in a situation where all of a sudden the rules of their brain are changed.
Mm-hmm. I had another experience working as a teenager, also my teenage, I guess all this fearful stuff comes from my teenage years. Working as a teenager at a motel late one evening, I heard a waitress coming down the hall to punch the time clock to go out. It was late in the evening. The restaurant had just closed. I hid in the punch clock room. I turned out the lights. And if that wasn't bad enough, I put my hand over the light switch so that when she reached around the corner to flip the switch, I grabbed her hand.
Oh, my God.
She did not speak to me for a very, very long time.
I think you didn't get shot or something. Because people just... I tell you, I was once, I rented a house in the country, and I went there sort of after the season had ended, and I guess there was some confusion between me and the guy who was renting it to me, whether I was going to be there or not. 3 o'clock in the morning, I awake to find myself at the doorway, and he was on the other side of the doorway. The doorknob was rattling, and what had happened was, 3 o'clock in the morning, the doorknob starts to rattle. It's not in the middle of the country. This is like Blair Witch territory.
Uh-huh.
I was up and out of bed before I was even consciously aware of what I was doing.
Yeah, yeah. So that's with the amygdala taking over. So this other thing that happens when we are scared, when we have a real fright, is we have different perceptions.
Right.
Our mental faculties change, and it even appears that time, in retrospect, slows.
Right.
And as if it's all recorded in high resolution and in slow motion for a replay. What's
right.
going on there?
Well, right. So there's that famous scene in the Matrix where the bullets are zooming at Keanu Reeves, but like you see each one as it's kind of coming towards you. Now, that's an exaggeration, but something similar to that does happen in real life where people report that things are falling in slow motion or the car is coming towards them and they can read the license plate and everything. And this has been demonstrated in actual psychological tests where a researcher took some people to this amusement park ride in Texas and it was actually, it drops them 150 feet through the air. And while they were going, he had asked them to read the display on this sort of wristwatch-like device to see if they could actually perceive time at a quicker rate. And he found that they couldn't. And so what he deduced was that, in fact, what's happening isn't that you're sort of taking, you're experiencing the world at a higher frame rate, like a motion picture camera at a higher frame rate, but that what's happening is that you're, because the fear is enabling your memory formation, what's happening is you're laying down a much richer trail of memory so that when you then go back and look at it, you have as much memory of this 5-second span as you normally would of a 5-minute span. And so since that's how we normally judge the progress of time, by how much stuff happens,
mm-hmm.
in retrospect, it seems like this little period of time took forever. I've had an enormous response to a blog post I wrote about explaining that experiment. People wrote in with all kinds of recollections that they had of being in near-fatal auto accidents and all sorts of things. And what's remarkable is not only does time seem to slow down, but the memories that we have of that instant is so vivid that it stands out long after everything else that happened that day has faded. And so as our lives get on, those things that stay with us are these sort of moments of intense emotional import. And like you in your plane, you remember that moment very clearly.
Mm-hmm. Ron from Waterloo writes that he grew up a bedwetter, and when he was about the age of five, he writes, "My father began a practice of checking my bed, and if it was wet, he would run cold water in the bathtub. He'd then drag me by the arm to the tub, make me strip and step into the chilly water. He then forced me face down, grabbed me by the throat, and repeatedly forced me, kicking violently to the bottom where he'd hold me for what seemed like an eternity. He did this to a dozen times each episode." Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
Ron writes, "I've never been able to separate these events from any thought of him and even family, but somehow worse than that were his constant threats to take me to school or just show up and out me as a bedwetter." So there's a fear, some stimuli that are not easily disconnected.
Wow.
You have a story in your book about a woman, I believe in Colorado, near Mesa Verde. She's in a canyon, and she is attacked by a mountain lion.
Right.
We talked about memories being deeply imprinted on the brain for years to come. She had, I was interested to hear in your writing, a moment or a length of time in which she completely forgot actually challenging this mountain lion and coming in, out with her life.
Yeah, it was at the most intense part of the encounter. Basically, she was a hydrologist, and she was taking water samples at the bottom of this canyon, and she noticed that a mountain lion was looking at her, and it proceeded to stalk her and chase her, and she chased her into the river. She tried to get away. She couldn't. She went through the various stages. There's at least four different kinds of panic, actually more depending on the different situation, but she went through all four of these, and after she got through all four, she basically just, her memory was just wiped out. And I guess what's happening is that, you know, this conscious part of our brain can get so shut down that it doesn't even form memories, that it's almost unconscious or dissociating, a kind of a blackout type condition like you sometimes see in alcoholism. It's a very understudied aspect of fear, because, you know, how would you ever find a human being to test in that kind of degree of fear? But it's mysterious. But, you know, for the most part, people have intensely vivid memories of their fearful times, and her case was really extreme.
My guest is science journalist Jeff Wise. His book, Extreme Fear: The Science of Your Brain in Danger, looks at the latest research on the brain's hidden fear pathways. If that name, Jeff Wise, sounds familiar to you, he also writes the I'll Try Anything column for Popular Mechanics, and joining us by phone from his home in Manhattan. Okay, so we've talked about some of the ways our brain reacts to fear. So in looking at the research, to what extent is panicking or not panicking a decision that is ours to make?
Right. It is absolutely not a decision that's ours to make. And, you know, I always found it kind of comical that one of the first pieces of advice you'll get, you know, from a survival point of view is don't panic. Because no one ever chooses to panic. And if you find yourself panicking, it's very, very difficult to just say, you know what, I really shouldn't be panicking right now. If you've never been in a life or death situation, you will surprise yourself. And some people surprise themselves at how well they're able to handle the situation. A friend of mine I was talking to about this sort of thing, and she said that she was in a situation where she was coming home late at night in the city. She was in a kind of a sketchy neighborhood, and she was assaulted, and she found herself speaking in a voice that she didn't even recognize as her own voice, saying, "You get away from here right now." And it worked, because she sort of, this authority came from her in a way that startled her. She had no idea that this capacity was within her. And this is one of the really fascinating aspects of the fear response, is the degree to which each one of us may have within ourselves a capacity for heroism that we will never know until that moment happens. Conversely, we might not. And you might think that you're a real tough guy who can bench 200 pounds at the gym, and then when something like this happens, you just go weak at the knees and and can't handle it. So it's an unknowable part of our minds until we find ourselves in that situation. And that I think, is one of the most fascinating things about it. It's a real mystery about our own nature as individuals.
Even though you say it's not up to us whether we panic or not, you do have in your book, according to the latest research, ways in which we can train ourselves not only to hold up under pressure, but to excel. Share some of those tips with us.
Right. Well, I divide them into two kinds. One is preparation before something happens to you. Because once the hairy stuff starts to go down, there isn't really any time to get yourself ready. You're basically going to be stuck with whatever you've got. So the first thing I would say is, if you are interested in being able to handle a danger situation, there are things that you can do. And this is something that the military deals with, sort of has dealt with for millions, thousands of years, which is, how do you get a bunch of people who are normal people and get them ready to go into a life or death situation? And the first thing that they do is what's called habituation, which is, you just get people used to the sights and the sounds of this potentially dangerous situation. And one of the things I wrote about in the book, as you alluded to earlier, was I went aboard this Navy ship. It's actually a simulated Navy ship near Chicago, where they've created like a nearly a life-size whole naval destroyer. And they have this is the last thing that an enlisted man will go through before they become an actual sailor. And about halfway through, I don't think I'm like spilling the beans here, but halfway through, things start to go crazy. There's a simulated missile attack. The whole thing shakes, and there's smoke, and there's sirens, and there's even like you're carrying dummies of guys screaming and gurgling and dying. And so it's an attempt to recreate as realistically as possible the sensations of battle. So this is called habituation, and it's something that, you know, you can do in daily life. If you're, say, maybe afraid of, you know, riding on the subway or something, you can, you know, habituate yourself to it by gradually exposing yourself to it more and more. And that's one of the things. You know, another thing that people can do if you really want to handle fear better is just become physically fit. People who are more fit are better at handling all kinds of stress. In fact, it's not, your previous guest highlighted the difference between fear and anxiety, but being physically fit helps you handle both.
Jeff Wise is with us. Let's go to a quick caller before our half hour with Jeff Wise ends. Dave is with us from Des Moines. How have you experienced fear, Dave?
Well, actually, he just answered a lot of my questions. I was calling, and when I was back in the Coast Guard, we used to have, we used to call it the laugh or puke syndrome. We would, if you chose not to laugh, you'd probably throw up with the amount of fear of what you had to do next. And he just kind of answered that, your guest, about habituation. But my question is, in going through a lot of this kind of thing and having been trained and having the habituation in place, there was still fear there. And for a lot of things, where does this fear go? I mean, I've read a lot of theories, like for post-traumatic stress syndrome. I mean, the actual fear goes in your tissue. It's never really gone. Or is it? I don't know.
Good question, Dave. We have a couple minutes left in our hour.
I'll get off the phone.
Dave, thanks for that from Des Moines. Jeff, your comments on Dave's experience there in the Coast Guard and
his great
question.
Well, the first is comment about puking or laughing. I mean, one of the tricks that we can use to try to overcome fear is just to feel another emotion, whether to laugh at it. And a lot of Green Berets and guys like that talk about, you know, just having a sense of humor, you know, trying to put it in another perspective. Or, you know, I talk about getting angry. You know, it's better to be angry than to be afraid.
In fact, the woman attacked by the mountain lion got angry. She was yelling at this mountain lion at the same time what she had her entire arm down this mountain lion's throat.
Right. So she'd gone from being sort of passive to kind of revving herself up and getting angry, and that was what really enabled her to go from sort of defensive posture to aggressive posture, and it saved her life, probably. But his final question was, where does fear go? And, you know, it does stay in your tissue, in a sense. You know, your amygdala is your brain tissue, and it retains memories of fearful things, and it never forgets, according to the current state of thought on the subject. And so you can never eliminate it, what you can do is sort of overwrite it and train yourself not to respond to that fear. But that fear can come back when it's triggered. And so fear is a very tricky thing to handle in that regard.
Jeff Wise, this is an excellent read. Fascinating book you've written here, Extreme Fear, The Science of Your Brain in Danger. It has so many anecdotes that you've collected here to match up, to pair with the scientific research on fear. Are you going to write something related next book?
My next book is about self-control, and it's related in that, like, as with fear, we're trying to control our emotions. I'm interested in how people control their urge to eat or to surf the internet too much or to drink or so forth.
Okay, Jeff Wise, looking forward to that new book, and thank you for this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jeff Wise, Extreme Fear, The Science of Your Brain in Danger. And The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Tomorrow at this time, climate change. It's already affecting the way Iowans live, work, and play. That's according to a new report by researchers at the state's universities. And we'll dive into the specifics of that report. We'll see how farming practices, food mitigation, flood mitigation efforts are changing, plus the consequences of warmer winters and longer growing seasons when we look at climate change tomorrow on the program. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.